Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, 2-1.
This is Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. I'm Jan van der Made in Paris.
Sweden is famous for a whole lot of things, such as the Swedish blonde, the very famous Dala pony, and of course, snus, the smokeless tobacco.
This morning, for me it was a problem. Can I take some toothpaste or not? I don't know. Do you know it?
Today we have a lot of different topics from all over Europe. There is a war going on within Europe between Sweden and the European Union about tobacco in a form you won't know. The EU is also worried about liquids when they are being taken into planes, and we look at how much fruit juice, if any at all, you can take on your next flight. We have a look at the upcoming elections in Poland and report on movements of people inside and towards the EU. And two of our stories center around Spain. We talk about crime committed by Romanian legal migrants there. And in another report, we look at the fate of underage Muslim illegals arriving at the Iberian Peninsula. And we end with sports. The Rugby World Championships are ongoing here in Paris and other French cities. And we look at the passion and organization of that sport in France. First we go to Poland. In 5 weeks' time, 2 years earlier than scheduled, the Polish people will be electing a new parliament. Is Poland in for a repeat of the political scenario of 2 years ago, when no party won enough support to form an independent majority government? Michael Kubicki reports.
Stwierdzam, że Sejm wymaganą większością głosów podjął uchwałę w sprawie skrócenia kadencji Sejmu Rzeczypospolitej.
The announcement by the Speaker of the House that the Parliament dissolved itself was followed by long cheers from almost all sides. Only 54 deputies from the smaller parties voted against the dissolution, a move which the opposition described as the capitulation of the conservative government of Jarosław Kaczyński. Surprisingly to many people, opinion polls show his Law and Justice Party running neck and neck with the Liberal Civic Platform. Political analysts here agree that Prime Minister Kaczyński came out of the blocks faster than his opponents, managing to present the dissolution of the parliament as an act of his courage rather than the failure of his cabinet. Comparisons with the 2005 elections are inevitable. At that time, the conservatives portray themselves as the advocates of a Poland of solidarity who will weed out corrupt networks, and the rival Civic Platform as the liberals whose policies were to benefit the rich. This year, polls choose from the same two major parties by label, but they know what the Law and Justice government looked like. And so they know, for instance, as Marcin Sobczyk of Interfax Central Europe in Warsaw stresses, that anti-corruption drive is among Law and Justice's central themes.
They know that the fight with corruption will continue. They don't have to guess that it will start. We also see certain developments, especially in the foreign policy front, that we weren't made aware of 2 years ago. Now we've had examples of the strong rhetoric towards Russia and Germany that is also likely to continue. This will appeal more to the rightist voter than 2 years ago, because 2 years ago a voter who supported such concepts would probably choose the far-right League of Polish Families.
The party, let me add, which stands little chance of getting into a new parliament. And how can one describe supporters of the Liberal Civic Platform, which 2 years ago was narrowly defeated by Law and Justice? Jacek Kucharczyk of the Institute of Public Affairs.
A person who is religious, who is a practicing Catholic, but a bit skeptical about mixing religion and public affairs, who is rather conservative in general, at the same time rather happy about Polish transition and the membership in the EU. I don't think that economic liberalism plays a major role in the mindset of a civic platform voter.
It may appear as a paradox of the political scene in Poland that in spite of the instability and scandals of the past 2 years, as well as allegations that Prime Minister Kaczyński used the secret services and the Justice Ministry to eliminate his former coalition partners from politics, Law and Justice is doing very well in the polls. Marcin Sobczyk explains.
I think that the country likes the fact that the leadership of that party very intelligently addresses the concerns of large group of citizens who were abandoned by previous governments and the political parties of the 1990s. Their concerns were not addressed because they were not seen as valuable in terms of political support. Now, this ruling party is addressing the concerns of people who live in provincial regions who believe that they have been hit by the post-1989 transition.
There is much to indicate that early parliamentary election will not bring lasting political stability in Poland. A left-wing alliance, which includes ex-communists and former anti-communist solidarity activists, is almost sure to come third in the election. The trouble is that, at this stage at least, it is an unlikely coalition partner for either of the two main players. For Network Europe, I am Michał Kubicki in Warsaw.
Sweden has been a member of the EU since 1995, but did you know that one of the most contentious issues for the Swedes during the negotiations, aside from the country's much-vaunted neutrality, was whether or not Swedes would be allowed to keep their peculiar habit of snus, or oral tobacco. Now, a decade on and smoking definitely out of favor, snus is being marketed as smokeless tobacco, and the question is whether it should be sold in other European member states. As Azaria Kiros explains, the snus empire wants to strike back.
Snus is a moist powder tobacco which is placed under the upper lip and squeezed to extract the tobacco juice for extended period of time. Snus is manufactured and consumed primarily in Sweden and Norway, although it has recently been introduced into other countries. Swedes, who've developed the habit for the snus, protect it jealously. But the European Union is not particularly excited about it. When Sweden joined the Union in 1995, Swedish authorities managed to get an exemption for the use of snus in Sweden, although the product was banned in the rest of the Union. The company which produces snus, Swedish Match, has been promoting the product with the argument that snus is less dangerous than smoking.
Sweden is famous for a whole lot of things, such as the elk, the Swedish blonde, the very famous Dala pony, and of course, snus, the smokeless tobacco. In modern society, there are a number of public places where smoking simply isn't allowed.
So what is the future of snus? The European Commission set up a scientific committee in an effort to answer that question. Professor Anders Albom of Karolinska Institute, a member of the scientific group, explains the guidelines given to his committee.
One of them was whether snuff use is linked to a health risk, which it is. And they also asked us if snuff use is addictive, which it is. And then they asked us what we think would happen if snuff use were made available in the rest of Europe. Currently, it's only allowed in Sweden, and it's not allowed in the other European countries. And so they asked us what would happen. Would it help to improve the public health if snuff use was made available? And the idea is that it would help people quit smoking cigarettes. And the answer is that we don't have any evidence to tell us that anything would be better if the snuff use were made free in the rest of Europe.
But that is not what Swedish Match, the Swedish company which produces the snus and other tobacco products, is concluding from the report. It says the EU Commission Scientific Committee is united in its conclusions that snus is less dangerous than smoking. Professor Lars-Erik Kvist is medical spokesperson for Swedish Match.
Up to now, the European health authorities have said that there is no scientific evidence that there are such tobacco products. But now, in this report, for the first time, a scientific committee has stated that there is such a product, and it's called Swedish snus, and that it's much safer than cigarettes.
So is snus less dangerous than smoking? The scientific committee says it is not arguing against the claim, but that does not definitely mean switching from cigarettes to snus entails less health risk.
Because one person switches from cigarette smoking to snuff, that would probably help that person. But the question is much more complex than that. You have an unknown number of former smokers who are now snuff users. in Sweden. And without snuff being available, they might even have been free from nicotine completely. And we don't know that number. And you also have a number of snuff users who have never been smokers. And they would have been free from nicotine if snuff had not been available.
Why has the snus debate proved so controversial? The question goes first to Professor Anders Albom of the EU Scientific Committee.
Simply because the tobacco industry is very interested in selling it. They see that cigarette smoking is going down, and then they are looking for other products to sell. The whole thing was started because the tobacco industry wants to get rid of the ban to sell snuff in the rest of Europe. So they are really behind all this work. And their argument is that snuff is less dangerous than cigarettes, which is true, but it's not really the question.
And what does the tobacco industry have to say about that? Swedish Match medical spokesperson, Professor Lars-Erik Kvist.
I think it's because the anti-tobacco movement has formulated their position more than 30 years ago, and that is all tobacco is evil, all tobacco is deadly.
Isn't it?
I don't think all tobacco is evil. I think the Swedish experience has shown that the availability of a much less risky alternative can prove to be very beneficial to public health. And the committee acknowledges the fact that the availability of snus in Sweden has had its positive effect on Swedish public health.
You're listening to Network Europe. If you're one of those travelers who gets frustrated by extra security measures at airports, you're not alone. It seems Europe's elected representatives think that we're taking security too far. The European Parliament in Strasbourg has just voted to scrap a ban on taking liquids on board of planes, saying that the measure is an expensive mistake and that there's no proof that it helps prevent terrorist attacks on planes. But will the powers that be actually lift the ban? Radio Netherlands, Vanessa reports.
Customs officials at airports have never been busier. Every day they see some 400 kilos of drinks from passengers leaving Schiphol Airport near Amsterdam. Add to that 60 kilos of aerosols like shaving mousse and top it off with 360 kilos of cosmetics like perfume bottles. And you end up with a grand total of 800 kilos a day taken by customs officials, all in the name of security. But what do the passengers make of it?
I think it's a bit exaggerated. If you got commercial products that have been pre-packed, like shaving foam and things like that, and they take it out of your hand luggage, I think that's a nuisance, and I don't think it changes anything to security.
I think every rule to improve the safety for the passengers is an improvement, so I have no problem with that.
I don't think they're evenly applied at all. I mean, I had two different destinations in 1 week. Actually, I had things that worked just fine, all legs of the trip. And then I got on to get onto a domestic flight. They weren't acceptable.
This morning, for me, it was a problem. Can I take some toothpaste or not? I don't know. Do you know it?
There's still a fair bit of confusion among passengers as to exactly why liquids can't be taken on board. Katelijn Bouterweg is a Dutch MEP and one of the many European parliamentarians who questions the need for these increased security measures.
The point is that this measure has been taken and that there is no evidence to back up the claim that it's very effective. On the contrary, we've had also here in the European Parliament a hearing with scientists who say, this is more a political measure, but actually, if you look at the scientific evidence, there's nothing to claim that this would really detect also a possible bomb. Now, if there's no evidence to say that this is an effective measure, we should have the courage also to review it, and that's the position of Parliament today.
The majority of the European Parliament has now voted to scrap the no liquids on board rule. But British MEP Michael Cashman says that's short-sighted.
You know, when we get into a car, we put on a seatbelt. We put on a seatbelt to prevent an accident taking place. We don't say we'll never have an accident. With all of these measures, they are precautionary. And we know from our own experience in the United Kingdom that we actually captured a group of people who were assembling the very chemicals and the very liquids necessary to produce one of these bombs. These measures, hopefully, will make certain that these attacks, whether on aircrafts or anywhere else, do not occur. They're preemptive, and that I'm certainly in favour of. I don't want to be accused accused of not having taken the right measures once an atrocity has taken place.
Ultimately, it's up to the European Commission in Brussels to decide whether to stick to the current rules when they come up for review later this autumn. But despite the political pressure from Parliament and from airports like Schiphol, European Commission officials have so far indicated that they see no reason to change the rules, and they insist that when it comes to security, it's far better to be safe than sorry.
Italy and Spain are the favorite destinations for Romanians looking for a better living. Having Romanians at work is beneficial for the economy, but in recent months an increasing number of crimes committed by Romanian citizens have made headlines in Italian and Spanish media. Julian Muresan of Radio Romania International reports from Bucharest.
Romania joined the European Union on January the 1st, 2007. Initially, the West feared a massive wave of immigration from Romania and Bulgaria. It wasn't really like that. Romanians have continued to go to work in Italy and Spain as they used to before Romania's entry in the EU. But in recent months, Italian and Spanish newspapers have abounded in rather unflattering articles about the Romanian communities there. In Italy, for instance, the Romanians are the biggest foreign community, numbering, according to official figures, 500,000. Miruna Căjvăneanu is a Romanian freelance journalist who has lived and studied in Italy.
We must say that Italy is a country who knew the immigration only on the latest years, so they are not accustomed to the immigrants and they don't really realize that the immigrants bring great value to the economy.
Last week, a Romanian set himself ablaze in Castellón, Spain. Desperate that he couldn't get a job, the 44-year-old man set fire to himself in a public square in front of his wife and kids. Now he's in hospital suffering from serious burns. Asked Romania's general consul in Sevilla, Mrs. Monica Stirbu, what is the Romanian state doing to help these people?
Every weekend we go to areas with a high concentration of Romanians to issue their papers and permits on the spot, so that they don't have to drive 1,000 kilometers to Sevilla. We also visit prisons and help Romanians involved in criminal suits with legal advice and so on.
In recent months, the Romanians in Italy have made the headlines with violent incidents. In April, a Romanian prostitute killed an Italian woman with an umbrella. Then another Romanian man killed an old couple with an axe. And recently, famous Italian film director Giuseppe Tornatore, winner of an Oscar for the best foreign film with his Nuovo Cinema Paradiso, was robbed by two Romanians. Miruna Căjvăneanu says Rome is not as safe as it used to be before the arrival of the immigrants. And according to her, the number of Romanians in prisons says a lot about criminality rates attributed to Romanian immigrants.
We are talking about Regina Celi in Rome, the main prison. And here the total of citizens from other countries is 500. And almost 300 of these are Romanian. So we cannot ignore this number because they are real.
The inhabitants of Rome are not very happy with the situation, nor are the Romanians. The latter blame the ethnic Roma for most evil doings. They blame them for ruining the reputation of the hard-working Romanians who are turning an honest penny abroad. So, both the Romanians in Romania and those working abroad claim the very term Roma is misleading, as it resembles the word Romanian. Therefore, many Romanians would rather use the term gypsy, which they do on every forum after a piece of news about the latest crimes committed by the ethnic Roma in Italy. You can read dozens of racist comments posted by frustrated Romanians, gloating over the fact that Europe has to deal now with a problem with which the Romanians have struggled for decades.
Crackdowns on illegal immigrants by Spain, meanwhile, have reduced the number of migrants coming from Africa. But one sort of immigrant is coming in greater numbers, underage North Africans. Temporary shelters for the young unaccompanied migrants are overflowing, and Muslim leaders are warning that they are ripe recruits for Islamic radicals. Jerome Sokolowski sent us this report.
Two teenage North Africans who came to Spain on their own are Sohail Baharu and Abdelghani Maroufi. They now live in an absorption center in the southern Spanish town of Écija. Sohail Baharu shows me his room, which is very tidy for a 19-year-old with a rapper's baseball cap and a ponytail. The CD player, one of his prized possessions, plays the latest music from North Africa. Sohail takes out a photo album.
I'm going to show you photos of a wedding. There's my cousin, and that's her husband. That's my mother with the whole family, the kids, everyone. Life is hard without your parents or anything, you know? It's just really hard.
Baharu turns off the music. Next to him sits 18-year-old Abdelghani Maroufi. Last year, he crossed the Strait of Gibraltar with 17 other underage migrants in a small fishing boat, or patera.
We spent 2 days at sea. There were 39 people, 18 minors, and the rest were adults. The waves were very high. I was afraid, but I knew that when I came here, being 17 years old, there would be a center that would help me get working papers.
Spain has an agreement with Morocco that allows Spanish authorities to deport Moroccan adults who arrive illegally almost immediately. But minors are a tricky issue. Spanish law says they can only be sent back if their parents are located. And often the parents in Morocco don't cooperate with efforts to locate them. That's the case even though some parents have been known to call the absorption centers in Spain to make sure their child arrived safely. The center here in Écija, about an hour from Seville, is run by a charity called Aproni. Here the young migrants get help in finding a job and applying for working papers. They learn Spanish and about Spanish society. On the table, there's a basket of free condoms. Elena Rodriguez of Aproni says social workers are realistic because nearly all of the teenage North Africans are male. Her view is in line with the laissez-faire attitude toward youth sexuality that predominates in Spain these days. As for the young migrants, Rodriguez says it's right that it's so hard to deport them.
If they've risked their lives to come in a patera or in the undercarriage of a bus, it's because of the conditions they live in their country of origin, because no one risks their life for nothing, so we are against deportation.
While North Africa struggles with poverty and political instability, Spain has a huge need for unskilled labor, especially in the booming construction sector. In the last half decade, the number of foreign-born adults has quadrupled to around 4 million, or 12% of Spain's population. According to government figures, more than 2,500 migrant minors arrived in Spain last year. More than a third came without parents. This year, the number appears to be growing. Authorities are converting schools and even an old shellfish plant into temporary absorption centers. In the Canary Islands, human rights monitors who visited the government-run shelters said they were prison-like. Elena Rodriguez says the government can't handle the influx and is turning for help to charities like hers.
The resources of the administration are collapsing. If so many young people are coming almost every day and there are not enough resources or centers, especially in the coastal provinces where they're arriving, then absorption centers have to be created at a fast pace.
But she warns that the new arrivals are diverting resources that normally go to Spanish teenagers with problems. Sohail and Abdelghani have lived in different Aproni shelters for more than a year now. Sohail has found a job, but he gets paid under the table, so it won't qualify him for working papers.
It's very tough to find work with a contract. They don't want to give it to you, especially if you're an immigrant and if you don't know someone who knows the right people.
Such difficulties make these youngsters a risk for all of Spanish society, warns Kamel Rahmouni. He's the director of the Association of Moroccan Immigrant Workers, which runs a shelter for migrant children in Madrid.
I think we can say this is an easy terrain for the radicals looking for people to indoctrinate. I think we can all agree on that. These kids, at their age, and with the amount of problems they have, can be easy prey and can easily fall into the hands of those radicals.
The imam of Madrid's largest mosque recently called the unaccompanied minors a time bomb. That's a loaded term here in Spain. The bombing of commuter trains 3 years ago in Madrid was allegedly carried out by a group of mainly young Moroccans who were inspired by Al-Qaeda's ideology. Muslim leaders say that cracking down on underage migration by trying to deport the young migrants will only increase the likelihood of radicalization. Instead, they say authorities need to work more on integrating the youngsters into Spanish society and finding them jobs. That's exactly what the foundation that runs the shelter here in Écija is trying to do. Jerome Sokolovsky, Deutsche Welle Radio, Écija, Spain.
And we end with sport. This year, France is hosting the Rugby World Cup from the 7th of September till the 20th of October. A full 6 weeks of what is billed as the third biggest sports event after the Football World Cup and the Olympics. 1,000 players from 20 countries, big and tiny, from all continents, are playing. We take a look at the passion for the sport and the organization of the tournament in France. Christine Pidgeot-Grier has this report.
The fierce New Zealand All Blacks are the team to beat. They're top in the world rugby standings and have been for ages. The French call their team Les Quinze de France. They've been training very hard all summer at the National Rugby Centre in Marcoussis, just outside Paris. That's where I caught up with the French team captain, Raphaël Ibáñez. I asked him how it feels to be playing in this World Cup.
To be honest, I think it's something fantastic. We know that hosting the World Cup in France could mean a lot of pressure on us. I've got no doubt, you know, there will be some pressure on the French team. But as a player, it's a big event. It's something you could only have in your dreams.
For some people, a rugby match is a brutal combat sport. There are punches and rough tackles by strong, stocky men. But those who love the sport say there are strong human values in it. The spirit of friendship, the teamwork, the sense of discipline, sacrifice and courage. Raphaël Ibáñez, captain of the French team, expresses his passion in this way.
It's a funny game. It's fantastic. You can really, really enjoy it because you need other people around you to achieve goals. And you win together, you lose together. And I think it's a good lesson for life.
Organizing such a huge event is a daunting task. Étienne Taubois is the chief of the 2007 World Cup Organizing Committee. His job is managing thousands of people.
We coordinate about 20,000 people, 6,000 volunteers. They're the smile of the tournament. They're probably the most important people. 4,000 press, 1,000 players, the suppliers, all the staff. All around, it's about 20,000 people working to make this tournament happen. It's about a 220 million budget. We're trying to be very ambitious in the sports presentation program, in all the activities that we bring around this World Cup. It's not only 48 matches of rugby. It's really a festival of 45 days.
Players from all continents mean special needs for many, and Taubois' crew has to respond.
You get people that are above 2 meters, so you need to have special beds, special shower things. And on the other hand, you have guys maybe 5'2". Within the team, there are big differences, and there are different needs, cultural needs, religious needs, food, things that are quite different. So it's there's an all kind of variety of things. We're really in the international event.
The global event also means fans from all over the world. Australian Tracy Close is operating manager of Rugby Town, the official village of rugby fans, right in front of the Eiffel Tower.
It's a place where fans from all around the world, all around Europe, all around sort of from the Southern Hemisphere can come to congregate here. And so far, I guess we've had quite a concentration of people from France because the first game was France versus Argentina. We've had a lot of people from Portugal, a lot of South Africans because South Africa played in Paris on the second day of the tournament. We've got quite a few Scottish in here today, quite a lot of English and some Australians.
The French economy and tourism stand to make money from this World Cup. A study by ESSEC, a business school in Paris, shows the 350,000 tourists coming to France will spend 1.5 billion euros in accommodation, food and leisure. And what about the French? Well, they're going to spend 2 billion euros. There are hundreds of books, magazines and sporting accessories on sale all over Paris, all linked to rugby. The sport also is omnipresent in exhibitions, in museums, photo shows, tattoo shops, restaurants. No shortage of guides on how to enjoy your time before, during and after the games. And now, I'm off to catch a game on the giant TV screen at my local café pub. For Network Europe in Paris, I'm Christine Pitzel-Gruyere.
And that brings us to the end of Network Europe for this week. Check details on previous or future programs on our website at www.networkeurope.org, with Network Europe written as one word. Don't forget to tune in same time next week. From me, Jan van der Made, goodbye.
Comment séduire une femme mariée? Comment faire le plus discrètement que ni son mari ni ses parents ne soient au courant? Fais-lui saisir en un mot sans passer pour un mégalo qu'une aventure sans lendemain lui ferait peut-être du bien. Est-elle heureuse avec lui? S'inquiète-t-elle quand il rentre à minuit? Attention, ce sont des clichés, il faut pas t'en occuper quand tu veux séduire une femme mariée. Faudrait tourner à ton avantage la situation, sans parler de l'âge de son vieux mari, ni même de se moquer de lui. C'est tentant mais ça se fait pas, surtout si ce bonhomme-là travaille au MEDEF ou dans une centrale EDF. Tu ne respectes rien, es-tu amoureux au moins? T'en sais rien, on ne confond pas séduction et gauche révolutionnaire quand on veut séduire une femme de notaire. Si tu lui parles de Venise ou bien de la Tour de Pise, évite les récits de voyage, les hôtels de passage. Préfère les histoires plus jolies. Un coup, j'étais en Amazonie avec des copains super marrants pour manger du serpent. Faut pas tout dire tout le temps. Laissez le plus souvent du mystère. Faudrait pas se tromper dans les noms des pays ni des régions quand on veut séduire la femme d'un pilote d'avion. Dernier cas le plus subtil, mais c'est aussi le plus difficile. Là, tu dois séduire ta propre femme. Elle les connaît, tous tes plans, mais elle les voudrait là maintenant. Didier, mon amour, séduis-moi, refais-moi la cour. Tu piétines, t'es engoncé. T'es aussi facile à repérer que quatre flics en civil en train de planquer dans une BM grise banalisée. Il a charmant racontant ton premier rarachage de dents et que tes parents t'avaient perdu un jour dans la rue. De ses yeux coule une larme. Tu n'as menti qu'à moitié, c'est le charme. Faut des trésors d'ingéniosité et aucune arrière-pensée quand on veut séduire une femme mariée. D'ingéniosité et aucune arrière-pensée quand on veut séduire une femme mariée. Et je m'y connais.